Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 23rd, 2006. Today's session is titled, If You Want Peace, Work for Water, presented by Kathy Dowd. The number is DOC 2006-05. Let's listen in.
And not just water conflicts. When I first thought about doing this session, I thought, well, it would be a nice thing just to go through some of the water conflicts that have been experienced throughout different regions of the world. But then, when I really started doing some of the reading, I thought, well, probably a lot of us have heard of many of these, or we know something about some in our own regions. And so I thought it might be better to hear people share what they know of water conflicts in their own regions, and to discuss some of what I think are the big questions in water conflicts, water use, water rights, things like that. So rather than just going through, like giving you a sort of lecture on the history of these water conflicts, thought I'd bring up maybe a couple of them and then start in on, you know, getting you to share some that you know about and then going through those questions. Okay. Of course, many of us, particularly people who are from the Midwest, and have things like the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River nearby, many of us just take water for granted. We turn on the tap, it's always there for us. We flush the toilet, no matter, you know, 100 times a day if we want to. We know that it's never gonna run out of water. And other people who are from more arid places like the Southwest, even though water is scarcer there, people still take water for granted. You turn on the tap whenever you want to, you wash your sheets whenever you want to, but more and more, you're starting to, even if you visit in those regions, you see the signs in the hotels that say, if you don't want to change your sheets, that will help us conserve water. If you can use your towels a second time, that will help us conserve water. So, I mean, certainly people are aware of it, and people who live in those places are aware of it, but they don't really have any true lack of water. Like, you don't experience a deficit of water as some other people do in the world, where, you know, you wash your dishes using a single cup of water, you know, maybe less than 8 ounces of water, and you wash all of the day's dishes in that. So certainly we take water for granted, and it probably would be good, even in areas where it's sort of endless, if we were more conscious of our water use in case we do move to those places where it is scarcer. Or because when you use all that water, it has to go through wastewater treatment facilities, and that takes energy and it takes chemicals and it takes a process to go through. But anyway, some of the water conflicts that I wanted to talk about were things like the Israeli-Palestinian water conflict, because of course we know there's a conflict over the land, and we know that that is a conflict that has been very difficult to settle. One of the reasons that it's been so difficult to settle is because of the water use issue. And the Israelis use about 2 to 3 times as much water per capita as the Palestinians do. But the Israeli settlers who go into places like the West Bank, the reports are that they use 6 to 10 times as much water as the Palestinians. And I don't think that it's more wasteful, but I think that because they're out in a more arid region and they're relying pretty heavily on agriculture in their settlements, I think that's the increase in water use in those places. But there have been attempts to try, and before that, this last big round of violence broke out several years ago, there have been some really good attempts to try and settle the conflict. And lots of those fell apart because of water rights issues. And Palestinians have been promised water that hasn't been delivered to them by the Israelis. So it's sort of a continuing issue there. Other places where it becomes important are places that, like the Indians and Pakistanis, wherever you share a watershed between different countries, because our political boundaries are, you could almost say, sort of haphazard. The water resources weren't considered in places where we started to draw political boundaries. So whenever you have to share a watershed between two different countries, you're gonna get conflicts between them because of it. Because you may feel like, The best thing to do on this river would be to build a dam so that we can control the amount of water when it comes to us and how we use it, or so that we can get hydroelectric power. But another country might think, well, you know, we use this for fishing, we take a little bit off for agriculture, but we'd like to see it in a more natural state, whatever. Another conflict that comes up in the news, sort of infrequently, but deals with the Great Lakes, is the Great Lakes being asked to shift some of their water resources to the southwest. And the governors of the Great Lakes have pretty well banded together, I think, to sort of keep that out of discussion, because they don't want to be shipping water to the growing regions of the southwest part of the United States. But that deals with one of the questions that I want to get into in a little bit. Let me ask you, what in regions where you live, what are water conflicts that you know about? Because certainly in the United States, there are a lot, even in regions that we think of as having plenty of water, there are water conflicts in those places.
Well, in the Midwest, I wouldn't call it a conflict, but whenever there's a drought, they'll do things. So people do kind of know there must be a shortage. It can't be unlimited, because they say you can't water your lawn, you can't wash your car. So it's not maybe as forever flowing as we think. If they have to institute that sort of things during a drought, the water table goes down.
Right, right.
Depending where your water comes from.
Right, and does everybody in your community follow those?
I don't know how well it's a little town where people are pretty law-abiding. So I think for the most part, when they do a sprinkler ban or a don't wash your car, they do.
Mm-hmm. And if you saw somebody using your sprinkler during that time, would you go and tell them?
I'd probably say something.
Yeah, you probably
would. I would, but but I think it's, you know, but they do impose that sort of thing, even in the Midwest where there's supposedly plenty of it.
Although it's always an advisory, right? It's
No, it's not advisory.
In the suburbs, it's a law.
Yeah, you get a nice hefty ticket if you sprinkle.
Yeah. In Washington, the Columbia River has been heavily dammed from Grand Coulee down, and there's a conflict between salmon. And some people say to save the salmon, we have to take down the dams, and they go off the snake tributary as well. And other people said there's more problems with the salmon than the water. You can take down all the dams and you're still going to have the salmon come back.
Right, right.
And spills. Of course, for the salmon usage, they'd like the dams to open up and spill out, and there are other reasons why the dams don't want to do that.
Yeah, and in some places where they have those dams, they build the fish ladders, if you've ever visited and seen those, and the fish sort of jump up the ladder and they make their way. And I've heard that those work pretty well, but they still are decreasing the number of salmon, because not all salmon will find their way up.
Now, my experience is they build the dams and salmon don't lose them very much.
Right, but if you go to the viewing, you can see tons of salmon going by.
It's right down there on the Rocky Reach down by Menachie there.
Right, right, they have a viewing area there.
I've been to the viewing areas and I'm not seeing fish, but that maybe was the wrong time.
Yeah, could be.
John Bonneville has some trained fish that goes around.
What's more fun is not to watch the fish, but to watch the fishermen. They're looking bug-eyed at all these big salmon swimming by.
It's sort of the same and sort of different. I believe in Chicago area, some of the suburbs, probably farther in than Cary was, were getting Chicago water, because Lake Michigan water, because their own wells were not able to provide enough. But then Chicago wants to charge them for it, plus they have to pipe through other communities. And so there have been some rather heated discussions of that in the past. Living western there, I kind of ignored them, but I remember reading something about that.
Yeah. You had your hand up back there?
I want to say, too, just being from the Northwest, where everybody thinks there's tons of water, we're put on water restrictions a lot of times. But then we ship it to Southern California, and when you go there, the water is sprinkling constantly. Mm-hmm. My daughter lived in San Diego, and they had no water restrictions. And also once when she, for a while, she lived in Las Vegas, and I just constantly talked about the water till I think she was sick of it. But they just didn't seem to have any either. They just watered everything. It was green, and our lawns are all brown because we couldn't water. Which were fine. People, you know, don't water if they ask you not to.
I You said they ship water from Washington to Southern California?
That's right.
How?
No.
I never heard of that.
I'm sorry, I don't know how.
There's been proposals to do that, but I've never heard anything happening.
No, they don't do it.
No.
Prohibitively expensive.
Well, they talk about having bags of salt in the oceans and so on.
Electricity, which is dependent upon the snow cycle, not to get electricity.
But yeah, electricity you can store in the grid, and you don't necessarily get that electricity, you just get some electricity. It doesn't mean it was made at that.
But the north.
So I don't know if.
Sure, but in Southern California, well, in California in general, you know, of course, I like the Mark Twain's comment about whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting about. But Sacramento for a long time didn't have meters, water meters.
Mm-hmm.
Insane. And the consumption, the average consumption in Sacramento is about twice what it was the rest of the state. But now we're getting to the place that we live in Orange County, and now they're talking about desalination plants. And we're fortunate, we have an aquifer, well actually there's three of them, top of three layers in our area that we get mostly our water from well water. But the aquifers are being drawn down, so right along our end of our little cul-de-sac street, there's a main street, and there are injection wells periodically along there to create a dynamic freshwater barrier against seawater intrusion.
Right.
Newport Beach didn't do that well enough, and they've lost their aquifer down in Newport
Ooh.
Beach. Where we live, it's okay, but they're trying, they're building more wells now because they keep drawing it down. And the cost of water from those wells is about $250 an acre foot. If they import the water from the Metropolitan Water District, which is from the Colorado primarily, or the California Water Project, it's about $500 an acre foot. And they estimate, of course, estimates on something new is probably too low, that desalination will cost about $1,000 an acre foot. Plus the other problems with desalination, which is things like, it's almost all reverse osmosis, that's the best way of doing it. Reverse osmosis, you know, about 10% of the water is concentrated minerals, which go back out to the ocean, and they're concerned about these concentrated minerals affecting the ecology in the ocean where the outfall pipe is, plus the energy cost.
Right,
they use high pressure pumps to pump the water into these membranes, which then pass through the water, the pure water.
Mm-hmm. And that, I think, has mostly been the limit to more desalination, is just the cost of energy and the great costs that come, that has been associated with that water. But, I mean, we never pay the true cost of water. I don't think no matter where you live, you pay the true cost of
well,
that water.
Well, we're doing an awful lot down there. What they're doing now, they're just working on a project, they try and, the Santa River is one of the big rivers down there. It only runs part of the year, and it's just dry part of the year. But they keep bulldozing little serpentine channels in the riverbed with the bulldozer, so that when the rains do come, then it's more likely to soak into the aquifers and underground aquifers.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not enough. So now what they've done, they've put the size of the pipe, huge pipe. They're running from the sewage plant, which is down close to the coast. They're running the water from this part of the water, from the sewage plant, through very fine filters at first, then they run it through reverse osmosis, then they have a tertiary treatment with ultraviolet light, then it goes out to a pool about 10 miles from the plant of this big pipe, and then it saturates and soaks into the ground, so they're recycling that way. That's a pretty expensive proposition, you know. But as population keeps growing in Southern California, you're going to have more and more problems like
yeah,
this.
I knew you'd bring up population today. That's definitely
well,
one.
It's the truth.
It really is.
Yeah.
It really is. Yeah.
Well, the issue, and there have been a number of proposals, primarily from California, to get water out of the Northwest. And it's not so much the amount of water they're talking about as the electrical power it would take to pump it, either up high enough to flow or to pump it along the way.
Right.
I saw somewhere a few years back that in California, half the electrical power in the state goes to moving water.
Mm. It's also the question of who's going to pay for all that expense.
Mm-hmm.
It
doesn't sound
yeah.
right.
If they have to pay for it themselves, I don't think they'll do it.
They
can afford it off
water.
On the federal taxpayers. That's not that good idea to them.
Yeah, you had your hand up.
I think one of the big problems with population, obviously, is a part of. And it's just, I mean, what's the median age of all of us here? And you think of one, this is really going to be even more of a problem. is kids, and when we were growing up, we weren't educated in general about this at all. And our kids today, man, the firemen come and talk to them all about, the water ecologists come and talk to them. And still in our house, I mean, if you're anywhere, lower middle class and up in the U.S., water isn't an everyday issue to you in general. My husband is a big fisherman and also in general ecologically minded. You know, you turn on a shower, you turn on the faucet, and it's there. And it's sort of like global warming not being a reality in front of their eyes every day, so they don't think about it. I mean, I'm the huge nag in our house because please don't let the water run the whole time you're doing the dishes, you know? Please don't let the water run the whole time you're brushing your teeth. And it's those are, yeah, I mean, the younger generation are the ones who really have to just be educated so much in their face daily because, you know, they just don't think about it. For our kids, if you go to a hotel, that's like they think one of the biggest things. Man, you can take a shower and drop your towel on the floor. And you show them, you know, because you don't do that at home. You show them, come on, guys. You know, you use a towel for a week at home. You don't have to throw it on the floor. And, you know, maybe it's my age and kids. I mean, I have four teenagers up here now. And I'm picking up something in the middle of the road that I know is theirs, you know? You know, they're basically good kids, but they, you know, it's they're figuring teenage level, you're nagging if you're doing it, you know? There's the label from Cutters in the middle of the road, and I go up, the label is peeled off of ours, you know? It's, I don't know, it's so frustrating.
What?
Yeah, those four good boys that you met yesterday, yeah. You know? They just, just the whole water thing is a constant frustrating thing with me at home. And my boys have definitely had all the information. They know about it, but still, it doesn't seem to
help. Well, I was just going to say, I don't know a lot about water, or I feel like I know a lot about water issues, but more about the communication and how it kind of waxes and wanes, how people hear about what's going on with water, and then we hear nothing. And I think, you know, I work in elementary school, and we used to get a lot of, you get a lot of free stuff on, oh, teach recycling lessons or different things, whatever. But I haven't seen a good one for water for, well, they're out there, but I don't see people using it. Maybe I should say that. So it's kind of out of communication, for at least I'm from the Minneapolis area.
Just something that hasn't come up recently. I think you've had your hand up for a while.
One thing we should remember about water is, unlike oil, it is not consumed. It's always going to be there. We don't use it up. Mm-hmm. But it can move from one place to another. It can be degraded. I think a good example of that is here in Washington. We live on the Columbia River. And the water we use probably goes back into the Columbia River and is not consumed. Although we live in a rather dry climate. Now, over in Seattle, Puget Sound, they have lots of rainfall, but their water effluent is out into Puget Sound in the ocean, where it's degraded. I think, and also in places like the Yakima River, the water is used for irrigation, but it probably tends to flow downstream. It's a very localized problem. You've got to look at what happens to water in individual places, and is it used up? In the Yakima Valley, a lot of water is used for agriculture. Most of this is evaporated. What happens to that? Well, the prevailing winds take that up to the east. It probably results in increased rainfall in Snake River and comes back down again. I think it's very complicated. Probably you have to look at water very locally as to what happens to it. And do you increase the supply? Do you simply move it a little bit? Do you move it downstream?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
But people move to a desert and then whine that there's no water. You know, I find that astounding. We had an aunt that moved to Phoenix to get away from all the plants in the Midwest that were making her sick. And they moved it there from the Midwest. They want their plants from the Midwest, so you have to irrigate your yard. You don't have a cactus, you got to have a lawn. And so then you've got to have all this water that nature didn't put there.
Then they've got the hay fever that they moved away.
Yeah, exactly. She's got the same rocky problems in Phoenix that she had in Green Bay because there's all those green plants. It just doesn't make sense to me because people move to places where there's no water and then we...
But they want all,
they want
like
all
that
the...
Before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mine sounds so trivial when I think of the problems that some of you are discussing. But I live on the Fox River west of Chicago. And it's primarily a recreational body of water north of us. But the dam upstream from us is controlled by people who are very, very interested in the recreation group. And those of us who are downstream from that dam very often have very, very low water levels because they're keeping the dams closed above us for the boaters. And it's a very selfish point of view, but it's the way it is, and it's the way it's going to be in McHenry County for 104 years, I think.
In Pierce County, just southeast of Tacoma, there's a lake, Lake Taps, which was built to provide hydroelectric power. That generating system is no longer economical for the company that owns it, and so they said, well, we're going to quit doing this. And of course, the people who own the very expensive waterfront property are really desperately trying to see what can we do to keep having a lake here when there's no longer a power company and dam keeping track of it. And they think what they're going to be able to do is to enter into agreement to sell some of that water to municipal water systems, but it's still very much a matter of concern and hard work before it finally gets settled.
Did I see your hand?
I have a whole bunch of things. Speaking of youth and people our age, the buying drinking water is, I was on the train on the way out here and they have nice water coming out of the train tap. And a teen got on and said, I want some water. And you know, the mom says, here's some. No, I mean real water out of a bottle. I know a lot of kids that won't drink water out of a tap.
That's right.
You know, and where does that water that's in a bottle come from and the conflicts with that?
It's basically what somebody else could be getting out of their tap because those bottling companies buy up local water supplies and they bottle it.
Well, if you see the machines they have in most of the supermarkets that you bring your own bottle and fill it, walk around back and look and you'll see a copper tube coming out of the wall
going
into the machine.
Sure. Yeah. A couple things. One, a correction. You made a comment about energy being able to be put onto the grid. That doesn't save the energy. That's not a storage. That's strictly distribution. The only way I've ever heard of energy going into the grid to be saved is when they, at night, pump it back uphill.
Yeah, I didn't mean saved.
Okay.
I meant,
okay.
But sent out into
sent
the grid,
out,
and then it goes, you know, so you don't necessarily get your energy, if you're buying your energy from this place,
right.
You're not necessarily getting that energy.
Right, that's right, okay. Degraded water, even, you know, years ago, you used to be able to come up in these mountains and drink from the streams, no problem at all. Now you've got to take a filter pump with you. You can't without, so water everywhere is degraded from the safety.
Did
of the
you really used to be able to drink water straight from these
streams?
Yes.
You wouldn't have to worry about like giardia or
no.
Well, how did you not have to worry about, you know, animals, fecal matter before if you do now? That's what I still don't understand.
That's what I
know. How could you have been
safe? It seemed to have been
safe.
I mean, people never
got
to live. I am drinking the bottled water, but I think I refilled this about 25 or 30 times so far.
They say you're not supposed to
because
the plastic degrades.
Well, it can't be. It doesn't stay here long enough to get anything into it, believe me. What I did want to bring up, though, was, and you guys from California can tell me if this has changed. We've got a fellow on the radio back in Chicago by the name of Orion Samuelson, who does a lot with agriculture in a lot of areas. And the two things I remember him saying after a plane trip out west and east 5-10 years ago, I don't remember which, was one, going across the western Great Plains and seeing these round rings where they're irrigating where they didn't have the water. And he said, it just seems wrong that we're growing crops that weren't intended for those areas and using so much water when there are other things we could grow there. Maybe you wouldn't make as much money on it, but it wouldn't. You'd be using so much of our water resources. And he said when he got to Southern California, and I think he was staying around San Diego, but that could be incorrect, what amazed him was there was absolutely nothing in place to catch the rainwater. When it rained, they ducted it immediately to try to get it out of the area. There were no attempt at retention or anything else. And that to him seemed like a horrible waste of this water that was coming down. We just get rid of it, get it out of here because it's a problem, rather than finding some way of building retention, not ponds, but lakes and this kind of stuff. You think of like New York water supplies, a lot of this eastern, they have the lake reservoirs is what they use them for. And it's not for energy, it's for drinking water. But he said he could see and find and could not have anybody tell him anything about trying to retain that water in the California with reservoirs. I don't know if that's changed since then or not.
Or even you can set up local rain barrels and water your lawn and your garden with the water that you catch.
We used to call it a cistern.
Cisterns, yeah.
I've mentioned one thing we do down here is they do bulldoze the serpentine channels in the river,
right.
So it will soak into the aquifers.
Right.
The other problem, though, is it's like the LA River, which is mostly concrete most of the year. It's all kinds of crud in it, and it's pretty foul stuff when it goes into the ocean. The other thing I was going to mention before, you talk about urban sprawl, indirectly what the population growth in California is doing is making more and more water districts contract with these irrigation districts for their water, and with the idea that they're going to let the farms just go fallow.
Right. And
to accommodate the population growth.
I had heard that some people were buying up agricultural land in California just to have the water rights that they could then sell to these communities, these growing communities.
It's a good deal, see, because the federal government put all this stuff in place many years ago and give these farmers a very, very low price on water. Now they're turning around and selling it to the cities like San Diego, it's particularly in the Imperial Valley water at a substantial price.
Right, and maybe it would be helpful if we talked a little bit about like water rights in the United States or the history of that, just briefly. In the humid eastern part of the United States where, of course, settlement started, basically if you had land that abutted a lake or a river, you could take water from that lake or river for your needs, but you were expected to return any excess to that stream. So you could take a little bit out for your house needs, if you needed any for irrigation, if you needed it to run like a grist mill, whatever, you could take what you needed. And they sort of changed that a little bit to sort of a priority right. You know, if you were building a mill that gave some good benefits to the community, then you had a priority use for that water over someone who maybe had a smaller mill and didn't employ as many people in those regions. As people started to move towards the west, where water got scarcer, water rights really changed drastically out there. And with the gold miners running out there and they needed to have water to sort of sort through their gold, whatever you call that process, they could take water and divert it from streams and then claim that water right. And if they were the first person there and they said, well, I need this much water to do this process, they had a senior claim on that water. And the people who moved there later could make claims on the rest of the water. So you would be a junior rights holder. And if you came to a several years where there's low precipitation amounts, if there wasn't enough water in that stream, the senior rights holders got their water, all they needed, all that they had their claim on, and the junior water rights holders didn't get any if there wasn't any left over. So there was no sense that, you know, a senior water user had to return any water back into the stream. He could just use it if he had a claim on it. And they sort of had to have a beneficial use to that water, so it's not like you could take it and just dump it somewhere. But if you could take it and dump it somewhere and nobody really knew about it, you could keep your claim on more water than you really needed. And so that still holds in the West, and that has affected the way water rights have developed in the West now. And in some places where I'm thinking of a community I visited in Colorado that I can't think of the name, Salida, Colorado. We talked to one of the water resources managers there. The town has the rights to so much water, and then agriculture in the region has the rights to so much water. And the town was able to buy up some of the senior water rights from users who were retiring out of agriculture or felt like they could get a lot of money from that water. So in that town, the water rights commissioner said, well, I really don't want them to use any conservation measures whatsoever. I want them to waste all of the water that they have a right to, because that returns it to the system sooner. And then my irrigators can get their hands on that water. So if people are watering their lawns, I mean, all that runoff runs back into the stream sooner or later, and that means his irrigators then have more water. But if the town is conserving water, then they still have the rights to all that water. So if they're conserving it, it just takes them longer to use it and longer for it to get down to his irrigators. So he was like, water your lawns, flush your toilets, run your taps, get all that water up.
Another story from our area. A few years ago when we had a real drought, they told us, you know, that, like Holden, if it's yellow, let it mellow and so on. Well, people let this mellow so much that the effluent from the sewage treatment plant has so much salt in it. They were using that effluent for irrigation along the roads, things like that. They had to add fresh water to make it usable for irrigation.
Oh, so you could have been flushing your toilet all the time.
A little irony there.
I think this water right system that you spoke of is part of our problem. That we need a better system than that for allocating water. It's, I think, completely out of date and inefficient.
Yeah.
Where are you from? You're from Washington.
Richard, Washington.
Yeah, well, if you change the system, then all those Californians are going to want Washington water.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. We should be the last, the Northwesterners should be the last ones to want to change the system.
Because if Californians will pay
you
more
for it, you've got to stand up for Northwestern water.
Californians have to pay for the water export from Washington. They're not going to pay for it. It's going to be too expensive.
No, they ship their people up there.
Californians have been known to be very covetous of our water. And they, so just
if they get out. The federal government for the cost of shipping it, they'll take it. They have to pay it themselves. They'll think twice.
Well, when Arnold gets to be president,
they'll figure out a way to tax us to subsidize their water consumption.
Kathy, go ahead.
You're talking about water in the United States, and somebody said, well, it's always a renewable, you know, source. But when you look at some of the ones that we were talking about, that the Earth already has billions more people than it can sustain or whatever. I don't know what the number was. It was in one of the discussions we were in. There's going to reach a point where it is going to be a problem, and there isn't enough
fresh clean water.
It's not just a renewable resource, and I think one of the numbers that you look at, isn't it, and they're sustaining life, and that we have too many people on the earth now, is how much fresh water there is. I know distribution is a problem. There's places that have it and places that don't. But eventually, if we don't conserve as a world, there isn't going to be enough. It's not just a local, my town doesn't have enough water.
Okay, let me ask you guys a question. Is water a right, like, you know, any of our civil rights? Is water a right, or is it a commodity to be sold?
Bought, depends sold. Whether or not you own it.
But can you own it, is the question. Does everybody have a right to fresh, clean water? Or is it only if you can afford to buy it?
Well, that's where you'll get the whole gray area. It should be a right for what you need. But then, of course, need is going to be relevant, you know. Is the need to have clean clothes, or is the need just to be able to drink it? And that's where you're mentioned in other parts of the world, where there's always going to be conflict over water.
Maybe you covered it, but living in Minnesota, where there are no water rights, and we are waiting for you and the coast to come and take our water, is there something that says, hey, there's no water here, you can't live here? You know, Las Vegas is booming, but there's no water. But they're going to come and say, let's drain Lake Superior. And we don't want you to grow water, but we're living there.
Right. Should we limit growth based on the availability of water? Or should people just be allowed to move where they want to, and then we bring in water from wherever we can find it?
Because we'd like to live up here too, but there's not room for everyone.
Yeah, like Las Vegas, there's other things to consider too. Las Vegas is right now trying to get water like about 200 miles north of there. And they're concerned now that in the Great Basin area that they're going to drain that water down so much that a lot of the natural springs are going to dry up. It's going to affect the whole ecology of the region, and it's going to be a real problem up
there. Right, because that water will never return then. It will take too much.
In our county, at least, you can't get building permits for a development unless you have water available to supply that. And the argument has been, how far back in the process do you have to demonstrate that? Is it only with the final plat or the original preliminary plat?
I heard that in the Denver region, they're wondering if they can make that kind of requirement, that the developers must show that this has a water source for so many years before they can develop and sell that land. And if they can sell houses without telling people, oh yeah, but you know the aquifer around here might run dry in 20 years, do they have to release that information to people, or is it buyer beware kind of thing?
Then you're talking the same thing about, you know, I don't want to say typical U.S., but power and greed. If you're saying, well, Las Vegas's problem is, and Las Vegas just continues to grow and grow, and I know there's a real lower class there, but in general, the water consumption, you're talking about the huge hotels, casinos, everything, which are for quasi-wealthy or whatever, and that's going to keep growing and growing because it's economical for it to. Mm-hmm. And there you're talking, you know, I'm not for regulations, and at the same time there you're talking about, gee, there should be something in plan there that it shouldn't be allowed to continue.
Right, but if we think of water as a right, then those people have a right to water, and if we're not using all the water in the Great Lakes, then shouldn't we give them?
But then you're talking about what's relevant, what's needed, and what's not. Just imagine what the water those hotels go through.
But if we think of then water as a commodity to be bought and sold, then won't we sell it according to its real cost, and won't that encourage conservation?
Yes.
But who owns that water? That's the question. It's a common thing, just like the air.
Yeah, I was going to think, I would compare, if we talk about air the same way, maybe we should be talking about air and water, the air that we breathe.
And there is a push around the world to privatize water, to privatize public water supplies in the Quad Cities. Some people were here from there before, from Wangasana. Davenport and Bettendorf, I think the water supply system is owned by, I can't remember if it's the French company or the German
company. There is a company.
But there are multinational corporations who own American water supply systems.
We just had a big article, I think a series, wasn't it, 2 or 3 days, discussing that problem, because there's a big question about how well they test their water and how well they filter it and things like this. Do they maintain their filtration plants well enough and things like that? Mm-hmm. There were some very serious cases of that.
And if they can privatize water, can they price it out of the reach of some members of the community? And is that okay to do that? Encourages conservation.
The other problem about the using water over and over again, like the Mississippi Valley, I mean the whole system, New Orleans gets the real crud down at the other end of the river. And there are things which they don't really test for that much. I'm not sure they know how to test for it that much. It's pharmaceuticals. They're using more and more medications. And whenever you use a medication, if it doesn't decompose right away, it goes down the sewage plant out to the river.
I think they have done testing. They have found elevated levels, from pharmaceuticals.
Well, they have some,
yeah.
I always tell students in my class when I teach water resources, well, the water that you're drinking right there in your water bottle, somebody peed in that in Minnesota, and they're disgusted by it. I don't know if you've ever thought of it, but it's pee water you're drinking, so.
Think should people in Las Vegas, especially people who may not be as economically, the workers or whatever it is down there versus the people visiting, have the right to the water in Lake Superior? This ties into the same thing. Should we really be rebuilding the portions of New Orleans that are lower than sea level just because we can ship water there? should we really be doing it? Should the mecca of play and fun in the Las Vegas thing be moved to someplace where it is more sustainable if we're going to have them? Now, I agree most of them probably don't want to go to Minnesota in the winter. But
the summer's nice.
But the summer's nice if you take a shotgun for the mosquitoes, you know. But it's a conundrum, is that the proper term for it? You know, it's not an easy solution. The other thing I was going to say, we keep talking United States. I was reading something relatively recently about in Africa around some of the game preserves where water rights are a big problem with that. They put the fences up to keep the wild animals out of the farm areas there, but what they found is normally done because of political swing, rather than being relatively fair about it, they take and run the fence so that the water is on the farmer's side and the wild animals in the preserves have to try to beat down the fence in order to get water. And it's a problem there too, the ecologists and the people who want the animals preserved versus the people who are trying to farm there and need the water to farm there.
A friend of mine has written a book about what used to be the estuary of the Colorado River in Mexico. Only it isn't anymore because the water never gets there because it's been used in the United States. So there is some question of equity and border and so forth.
Yeah. Right, because
in
their culture
that direction
has,
too.
Yeah, their culture in that region has totally changed. They used to be fishermen, and now you have to get in the truck and pull your boat out to the water that used to be basically in your front yard.
One part of the problem, I think, is people pointed out that the water is becoming increasingly polluted and therefore less useful. So it seems to be part of the solution of this, maybe better water treatment. Instead of just dumping our sewage into the rivers and lakes, treat it so that we discharge pure water.
Yeah. Well,
we do that.
I mean, we do treat
all of our
wastewater.
We do a better job.
But then define pure water. I mean, how much do you want to pay to clean your water before you determine it's clean enough to discharge back into the rivers? I mean, how much are you willing to pay for that, I guess? At what point do you say, this is clean water? Because you're never going to get pure water. Pure water rarely exists because water can dissolve anything that it basically passes over.
I suspect though in many places we do a better job.
Yeah, I think so.
But part of the problem, too, is we're not just talking with sewage. What about all the agricultural runoff? And you don't treat that. Mm-hmm. And that'll go into some little stream. That'll go into a bigger stream. That'll go into a river. And there's no control over the agricultural runoff. It's just whatever the farmer puts on his field eventually is going to end up in your water supply.
And you talked about drugs in the water. When my husband died, I had a stash of morphine. Well, I had to put it down my toilet while the hospice people watched to make sure that that's where that morphine went. Well, I mean, how many people are dumping morphine down their toilets?
Yeah, that is not the way to dispose of drugs. You're supposed to take it to the pharmacy and they...
That's not the hospice people made her do that.
In Illinois.
How long ago was that?
A year and a half.
Ago.
Wow.
They wanted to make sure you weren't going to use it.
Yeah,
they made her do that.
Yeah, you're not even supposed to throw like your aspirin down there. You should, if you have it to dispose of, you should take it back to your pharmacy.
That's what they...
Interesting.
Where is that?
Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Boy, so whoever was downstream, they were probably feeling pretty good.
The whole city of Belgium was getting back to their people.
Wow.
And how many other people did they tell have them do that?
Yeah. I mean, I can understand that as a controlled substance, but it doesn't seem
doesn't seem like the right solution.
No, it doesn't. Go ahead.
Well, what do you know about Israel, that conflict over there? Because the way I understand it, what I've read, is that the main aquifer in the whole Palestinian area is under the West Bank.
Yes.
And I just don't see Israel ever giving up the rights of that water. The Jordan River now has been so diverted that the Dead Sea is now two seas. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, I was over there 20 years ago, and it was two parts. And they had dug a channel between the two parts of the Dead Sea. But it's gone down so much because of the lack of inflow that there's actually two parts to it now. It's not one Dead Sea anymore.
Yeah.
And it's used for irrigation and as well as burgeoning population.
I have seen Palestinians complain that Israelis are taking so much water out of that aquifer that you have seawater intrusion coming in, and so it may be to the point where it's irreversible. Like you talked about in California, like the same things have happened in Miami. So they may be at a loss of water that can't be reclaimed later.
Isn't Turkey building a big dam on the Tigris Euphrates, which
they have a dam on there.
Yeah.
And I think in the last, the current Iraq war, I think it was, did we think about turning off the water to Iraq from that dam, like getting Turkey to stop the flow of water as a sort of a weapon? Because I guess that's another topic we could talk about, and that's water resources used as a target or a weapon during wars. If you think about in that first Iraq war, you've probably heard of the Marsh Arabs. And Saddam Hussein had drained the marshes because insurgents were hiding in the marshes. And so in order to get at them, he drained the water out of there, which totally ruined the lifestyle and culture of the people who had been relying on those marshes. And I think that in the bills to fund the current Iraq war, there has been funding to rebuild the marshes, but I think that was cut.
They're trying to. The question is, can they succeed or not? You know, it's like wetlands. Once you drain them, can you really rebuild them easily or not?
Right, right. And I think I read that there were soldiers, American soldiers, who were just breaking some of the dams and allowing water to return to that area, but I think it's a pretty expensive process. So I guess how much money do we as a country, do the United States as a country invest in restoring something like the marshes, when you could say that we were responsible for those marshes being drained because we started that first Gulf War, which sort of brought up those insurgents and led them to hide in the marshes that were then drained.
Was that because of that war or because of the Iranian Iraqi war?
I'm pretty sure it was because of our first Gulf War started insurgents.
We were going to come to their aid.
Yeah, and we just sort of abandoned them, and that's when all those people got killed. I think that's a confusing process. Okay, one more question for you. We're almost done here. Is a river more valuable as water, as the water you can get from it, or as a river, a system? You know, especially out in the West, we I think tend to think of rivers as our water supply. But is it more important to have a functioning ecosystem? Is that more valuable to humanity, or is that water that we can withdraw from it and support a population more valuable? And who decides those things, I guess?
Well, the Mississippi and the Ohio are definitely major transportation things also.
Mm-hmm.
Commerce.
Move
a lot of stuff. I forget how many,
a lot of goods.
How many boxcar loads
right.
of grain go into one barge. So it's a very efficient from that standpoint.
Mm-hmm. It's cheap.
Cheap energy wise. So, and if you tie cheapness to the energy required to move it, and that may or may not be a good thing. If it's cheap, that means it's relatively energy efficient compared to the non-cheap way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. You're talking the whole problem with perfect world and population, and to you know what's necessary and what should be or would like to be. I think as far as leaving it or using it.
Do we, as a Christian community here, do we have any, or can we come to an understanding of water's value as either a right or a commodity, or the value of a river as a river versus a water supply? Can we learn anything from Christian teachings that can help us answer these questions?
You know, this Holden's kind of a microcosm in some respects. You know, the whole community is kind of isolated. And I often wondered what would happen if some people started coming up on the boat without reservations and ask for a place to live. Well, can we camp in the ballpark or something like that? Can we stay here for a while? How about, can we eat here? Can we tap into your electricity? We have a very tight population control in Holden Village.
Mm-hmm.
Summer and winter. Winter is even more tight because of the limited power we've generated, hydro plants and so on. You know, is there a lesson there? Are we just living this way and ignoring the world? You know, it's an interesting thing to think about. What would happen if you start getting an awful lot of immigration into Holden Village? What would we do? Send them back down on the bus?
That was brought up at breakfast this morning, too, about, you know, we think of ourselves as being very ecological and this kind of stuff, but if you look at the fossil fuels required to get the food up here and all the stuff
that we're
using.
Here. Yeah, how many of you would have come if you knew there was a 10-mile hike with all your stuff?
Right.
At the end of that ferry ride.
Or had you know, and a 12-mile hike up there.
Yeah, if you had the canoe up. I wouldn't be here.
So we're not as ecological and isolated as we like to think ourselves.
The potential for change in the world that happens here, though, makes it all important here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
but could
there
we
are,
do these
we racialize
things?
It.
No, well, the gathering of the people, I mean, every week is so unique, and to send them back out into the world, you got to have places like.
But couldn't we do this in a place where it was more accessible?
Not as effective.
No, it wouldn't work.
Because you need that isolation?
Yeah. You've got to be away from telephones and TVs. And.
Yeah, I don't really have a TV at home. We have a DVD player so we can rent and watch things.
And
so
computers
I don't have a telephone
and email and all that stuff.
I have access at home. So I'm actually more isolated at home than I am in a place like this.
But you're not the norm.
Yeah, I guess so.
No. I mean, for me to say there's 2 days a week that there's no television, you would think I'm a Nazi dictator, you know.
Kathy wouldn't let me get away with it. She's got to watch her ball games.
Well, the Cubs, so everybody can understand that.
Yes, it's a disease.
Isn't it sad?
A normal, reasonably intelligent person is a Cub.
Actually, I'm going to be gone from home almost 14 days, and how much driving would I do if I was at home?
That's true.
I'm on a vacation from fossil fuels once I get here.
Yeah, that's
know.
True.
Once you get here.
Well, that all depends on how you can set things up. I'm in the fortunate position that when I moved out to Morrison, people said I should live in Clinton or Sterling because that's where the action is. I was a bachelor at the time, and I opted to live in the town where the company was.
Clinton or Sterling was the action for
that was curious.
That sounds awful.
Clinton or Sterling at McDonald's, that's the big difference.
But what that has enabled me to do is 95% of the days I've worked so far this year, I walk to work. So I, you know, there are times I don't put gas in the vehicle that I drive once a month.
Yeah, sometimes you can wait out those high gas prices until it comes back down.
Most of us aren't that fortunate, though.
Yeah.
I was fortunate to be able to take I live a mile and a half from where I work, and I enjoy walking, and I do it. There are people that live two blocks from work and fire up the car every day to go to work. I have to figure that out.
Right, and some of that is being fortunate, and other is making a conscious choice to live close to where you work.
The conscious choice.
But when
choice,
you have two
right, the conscious
people
choice
in your household,
was not to go here, but to stay here, because why should I go here every day, when if I want to go there, I can do it only once or twice a week if I want to.
Right, but if you have two workers in your household,
I don't walk the 20 miles
to
my job.
Right,
you know, so.
Yeah.
Somebody has to give.
Yeah.
You said when she earns more than I do, we'll move closer to her job.
That is true 100%. What she just said about all the fossil fuels in general, that all of us would be using everything if we weren't here. So I think that would more than make up the difference.
I think you're right.
It costs to send food up.
There is something here that I've noticed has been very much missing, and that is bottled water, which to me is the biggest ripoff in the world. And a nun in our community said if everyone would quit drinking bottled water and either give the money from those petrochemicals to make the bottles, everyone in the world could have free water because we could afford to do wells for everyone. And to me, someone should shoot the Perrier people who started this mess.
Well,
maybe because I come from a place of good quality water, but to pay a dollar for something that's free, and then you have this trash that's really not usable because we're making too many plastic bottles, it just blows my mind.
But at the same time, when we want our kids drinking, whether it's cool or whatever now, I'd rather have them drinking water out of those plastic bottles than Pepsi out of those plastic bottles.
Well, I just send them to their own canteen.
Oh, we did. We all have Nalgene bottles.
But before Perry and I started doing that, we were not providing free water to the world. So what makes you think that if we didn't
But look at the amount of bottles we go through. It's just ridiculous.
It's the bottles.
Right now, this is Coca-Cola's biggest money maker.
It is.
I've been working with Coca-Cola on energy reduction and stuff, and talking to people. The Dasani water is their biggest money maker.
Right, because it's the water they make their Coke with, but they don't put all the other ingredients. So they charge the same price, but
what does it cost them?
But it costs less, so the profit.
A normal Coke, I think, like they say, at a fountain or something, is like a penny and a half.
But environmentally, you've got this trash to get.
But you have the trash when they put Pepsi in it too. And I'd rather spend $1 for a bottle of water for my kids than spend a quarter for a can of Pepsi.
I agree with you, too. There's still all the trash with Pepsi.
These can be recycled, and at least in our town. We do recycling. This stuff is recyclable, and you can turn it some park benches if nothing else.
Recycling takes energy, so don't let that make you feel like you're off the hook.
Okay. If I once again go back to the dollar as the means of evaluating energy use, and once again, I don't know if that's valid, but if I make that assumption, we used to use all glass bottles, which were recycled. Mm-hmm. You know, they took them, washed them, and you had some broke, and the glass could be remelted. But for some reason, it's less expensive, and don't tell me it isn't less expensive, because if it was less expensive to use glass, they'd still be doing it. It must be less expensive, so somehow there must be a less energy involved in this. Someplace all up and down the chain.
But my question is, why don't you go to the drinking fountain?
Okay, but that's unfortunately something that in our society now, and even not just ours, but over the world, it's not going to change. We're not going to get our kids to just go get a glass out of the cupboard, even though they do. Total, but they're going to drink Gatorade and Powerade and Pepsi and Coke and everything else. And if they're going to have all those choices, I'd rather spend my dollar on a bottle of water.
But I have two young grandchildren who have never tasted Coke or Pepsi or any of that.
That's great. And we don't have it at home.
And if
but once they're older, you're not going to control every time they go to McDonald's
if
you're on a new
life. But if you start with them young, they don't like the taste of it, for one thing.
That's true. Well, it doesn't taste good. It's a quasi-addiction or whatever, too. If you really think about it when you're drinking it, not many people...
If you really want to get somebody not to drink pop if they haven't before, get some year-and-a-half or two-year-old diet pop. Seriously.
Yeah,
the shelf life on regular Coca-Cola, something else I learned, is roughly 6 months, and then the taste starts to degrade.
Really?
The shelf life on the diet pops, because of sweeteners in it, is 1 month. We have some in our plant that we've been using for testing on energy efficiency of pop machines and stuff, trying to help on that. That was like 2 years old. It had some dented cans. They opened one of those. We really think if you spill one of those, you need to bring out the hazmat squad. It's ugly stuff.
The question Kathy raised, how does the Christian tradition inform this issue? Now, when this mine was created, in the late 40s, I believe, it didn't inform a lot of how the mine operated. There were these tailing piles, which we're now going to be remediating soon, but all that effluent just went right out into Lake Chelan without a thought for how it affected fish and other creatures. Now we have something like this mural that I think is informed by a new understanding of what the meaning of Christianity is, and I think, but it requires a new interpretation, a new understanding. It's probably not an understanding that even Christ could have conceived of in his day. But when you think of the theme of the village, I am with you always. Okay, who is the you? Well, traditionally, the you is the body of Christ or humanity. But suppose the you is a broader circle of all the creatures of creation. Mm-hmm. Now, there's nothing that precludes us from thinking of the Christian tradition in that way. And the last judgment of Matthew, the least of these are your brethren, and when you feed them, clothe them, think of yourself as clothing me, Jesus, right? Well, suppose the least of these are not humans, but endangered species or endangered ecosystems.
So I think that the Christian tradition can definitely accommodate a more holistic understanding that we need to love not just our neighbor human being, but we need to love our neighbor ecosystem, our neighbor deer and bear, and even hard to conceive of it, our neighbor plankton, maybe.
bacteria.
But I mean, you know, we got to think in terms of the whole system now, and how even the microbes, when they get angry, can bring about plagues and other things that, you know, we are the greatest enemy, perhaps, that we need to face in the long term may well be viruses and other things. So we need to think in terms of the big picture. And I think our traditional can make room for that.
But how do you then get this community to go home and somehow spread that message in the face of maybe some other belief systems that say, well, it doesn't matter what we do here because the rapture is coming and it's going to be over in 3 years.
That's true. It could be self-fulfilling.
Maybe it will be.
And, you know, then you can think of our theology can also accommodate, I think, the end of this experiment, Homo sapiens. The experiment can well end, and God may well do little more than weep as we become extinct, just as Elie Wiesel says that God wept at the hanging of Jews in the concentration camps in the Holocaust. I mean, God isn't going to stop us from our folly. God may weep, but it's up to us. And plenty of other solar systems with intelligent life that may well become successful experiments. The question for us is, are we going to become a successful experiment of intelligent life on this planet, or are we going to become one of a failure? Right now, we're definitely at a fork in the road. I think there's still time for choice in this matter, but denial is no longer an option.
That's right.
If our world were a system that you had created as your science experiment for the science fair project in eighth grade, I mean, wouldn't you be happy if you saw the humans sort of wear themselves out and fade away, because then you could see what else could happen on Earth that has been so controlled by those humans? So I wonder if God would weep at our loss, or if he would rejoice and say, oh, it's about time
it's
we
about
have those
time. Got
other species that can have more room to
Did God weep at the extinction of the dinosaurs? I don't know. You know, if we become extinct, I don't think that humanity has the power to make this a lifeless planet. There, evolution will probably continue in some way, and something new will
if there's nothing else, there will be cockroaches.
If nothing else, there will be
mosquitoes.
And on that note, we will